Ivan Cantu is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Cantu to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state that carries out a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Pat McCann, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Snyder, general reporter Clinton Young, and an exclusive interview with Cantu, recorded last year on death row by Execution Watch, broadcast here for the first time. The Execution Watch for Ivan Cantu begins.
Tonight, the state of Texas ushers Ivan Cantu into the death chamber. To our listeners around the world, thank you for joining us on this Wednesday, February the 28th, 2024 edition of Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for So What's Your Story on KPFT Houston, they'll be back next week in their regularly scheduled time slot of 6 p.m. Execution Watch is brought to you in part by the Clinton Young Foundation, and it is produced by a dedicated staff of volunteers. You'll find more information on how to support us at kpft.org. First, before we get started, Larry Douglas, our lead legal analyst, give us a little rundown on this case.
Well, Marlo, on November the 4th, 2000, the bodies of James Mosqueda and his living fiancée, Amy Kitchen, were found in their residence. Mosqueda's body was found face up in their bed, and Kitchen's body was found face down on the floor next to the bed. There were no indications of a struggle or any kind of forced entry in their home, and later on, the autopsy report showed that Mosqueda's body had one bullet to the head, and Kitchen's body contained four bullets. Tonight, we're going to explore how the incidents that followed these killings resulted in Ivan Cantu right now facing execution by legal injection.
We are going to be joined a little bit later on with Pat McCann, also one of our legal analysts. But first, let's go ahead and check in with Linda Snyder, who is standing outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas. Linda, how are
you? Yes. Two residents.
Give us a little idea of what's going on where you are today.
Okay, we have about 60 people out here today. That's great. We have a great crowd.
That's amazing.
We have a lot of Ivan's family is out here with us, too.
We've been seeing them protesting throughout on the different courthouses and stuff. That's really great that they are there with you. 60 people, that's very unusual to be protesting these days. Yes.
Yes, we don't normally have that many.
Linda, what can you tell us about Mr. Cantu?
He's a very nice person, and I really believe he's totally innocent. I've always believed he was innocent, but, you know, they're not going to listen to me.
But you wish they would, yeah.
Yes, I wish they would.
So what is the atmosphere like with that many people? Are they all protesting the same thing, or are there people in opposition?
They want the death penalty to stop for Texas completely.
Do you have an opportunity ever to talk to these people? Are they specifically saying that? These seem to be new people to your cause.
Yes, they want it to stop. We don't have anybody over here, you know, that says anything different. They want the executions in Texas to stop.
There's been a lot of international and national attention to Mr. Cantu's case because of so many different disparities. Do you think that raising the profile of the executions going on here in Texas is a good thing?
Yes, I think it is. People need to really know what's happening.
Right. Any news?
We just got to get people to listen to it.
Yes, totally agree. I understand. So any news? I know that we have already gone through both the Fifth Circuit and the Texas. Any news from any chance?
No, they're not filing anything in the Supreme Court. They said they don't have anything to go on. I don't understand that. None of us here understand that. We think something should be filed. Well, but his attorney said she doesn't know anything.
I'll tell you what.
Anything viable. So
we're going to talk with Pat McCann and Larry Douglas, and we'll see what they have to say about that. Please let us know when they cross the road or any other signal that you may be looking for to let us know that the execution is starting.
All right.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you so much. And let's go straight with Larry Douglas. Here we go. This is Ivan's third date with death. His first date was back in 2011, and then last year again in 2023. But can you tell us how this all started? Tell us about the case itself.
Well, Marlo, the case itself raises a lot of questions about our legal system. We've got a great system, but it's not a perfect system. And the way the thing got started is that, again, James Mosqueda was killed. And so was his live-in fiancée, Amy Kitchen. Now, Ivan Cantu happened to be the cousin of James Mosqueda. They were, in fact, Mosqueda was described as being a business person who had hired his cousin Ivan to work with him, and had fired him a few months earlier. But anyway, when the killing occurred, the way the case was developed. Well, the real issue right here is the evidence that was admitted against him. Now, I get clients every day saying, well, you know, they don't have any evidence against me. You explain to them, well, the fact that we've got witnesses, and the witnesses, testimony, evidence is good evidence. But even physical evidence doesn't even get in without the testimony of a person. So Ivan was charged based on a lot of testimonial evidence, primarily from Amy Butcher and her brother Jeff. These were roommates of Ivan's. And so when Mosqueda was killed, those roommates came forward and gave a lot of testimony against Ivan. The brother says, well, yeah, Ivan told me he was going to kill going to kill Mosqueda. And the girlfriend roommate, Amy Butcher, said, oh, yeah, he said when he left, he says, I'm going to go get it done. And he came back and said, you know, it wasn't pretty. And he came back and he gave me some clothing and told me to throw them away. So I put them in the trash can. But she didn't throw them away, and they were later found. The other thing is Jeff Butcher says, oh yeah. He told me he was going to kill him. And so that put everything on Ivan. Ivan's all along said, no, my cousin James was not that great a business person. He was a drug dealer, and I think this looks to me like a drug hit. But that was never followed up on. And so the state put together its case seeking to show through evidence such as the location of Mosqueda's car, the blood-soaked clothing that was reported to be Ivan's clothing, Ivan Cantu's clothing, and a weapon deemed to be the murder weapon, which supposedly contained Ivan's fingerprints. Well, it turns out Ivan's fingerprints were not on the weapon itself, but they were on the magazine. And the weapon itself was found in the home of one of Ivan's Cantu's former girlfriends. So with this testimony evidence, everything came in, and the state introduced through all those witnesses, 34 witnesses, in the guilt innocence phase, the whole theory that Ivan Cantu was jealous of his cousin who was doing a whole lot better and set out to kill his cousin. And so and the almost everything was developed through these two witnesses. Now, the trouble with this case now is that 20 years later, when Ivan's former girlfriend, Amy Butcher, she died. And before she died, she confessed apparently to her brothers that, you know, it didn't happen that way. But I was afraid that I was going to get killed because I'm between these two rival drug gangs. They were all druggies, according to Ivan and according to Butcher and his sister. Said we were all doing drugs. I was afraid of being killed. So that's why I cooperated with the state. And so when she died, Jeff now, she died in 21. Jeff then goes to everybody who would listen to him saying, I lied too. None of this happened. It didn't happen that way. The problem is we've got a system that has procedures. And Ivan Cantu had access to all of those procedures, not to this these recanting witnesses until very recently. And so the system, for whatever reason, for reasons of finality, actually, decided that we were not going to proceed to do a very thorough background check of the various of the witnesses, because their attitude is the witnesses testified as they did. Not only that, but the jurors, including the four person of the jury, says, if I'd known some of this stuff, I would not have sent this man to death row. This is just wrong. And so now it's a matter of what can we do when there is at least some suggestion that we got it wrong this time. Now, the law gets it wrong from time to time anyway. We recognize that. We recognize there are people who own death row when the system got it wrong. But then what is the remedy, and when can the remedy be applied, and who's responsible for applying that remedy?
Right.
That's why we're here. That's why we're here tonight.
Seems like that's how we got there. Let's hear a little more from you, Pat McCann, our other legal analyst. Deathbed confessions. This all has the sounds of a murder podcast. Tell us a little bit more.
Well, first, thank you for having me on. And second, I'm sorry if the visibility is a little hard for some of your viewers, but the lighting is bad on this. But in the basics of this are that a key witness recanted. And historically, hearsay rules that bar admission of other people's testimony that somebody heard. There's an exception in that called literally a dying declaration. And this person was clearly trying to clear her conscience. Now, perhaps that wasn't enough. Perhaps it was, you know, too late. But it is interesting that that has not been delved into more, and that the state court has not wanted to pursue that, or that the district attorney's office knew that this was false testimony. So it's a frustrating situation where by procedural rules that something wasn't raised the first time, or that it should have been raised in a you know, different manner is going to result in an execution when, you know, quite frankly, it seems as if there are legitimate reasons to grant a stay to at least explore this. And I'm not going to pretend I know the truth. I'm simply saying that if there's a recantation, granted perhaps a deathbed one, but doesn't that have the ring of truth that you're looking at? In order to explore something more deeply and perhaps conduct a real investigation of, you know, either the district attorney who sponsored this testimony or the person who gave it. And you know, I am very sad that the death of this witness has resulted in a situation where we're about to have a second death without any real examination of those claims. And I wish that was not so, but as Larry said, this is a flawed system, deeply so in this case, because the truth is not even being looked at for procedural rules. So,
here we are. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles unanimously denied Cantu's clemency application on Monday, I guess, and both the state's highest criminal court and the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals denied his last-minute request to stay the execution. He is going to be, it looks like this is going to be the case, the first person to be executed by the state of Texas in 2024. I'm curious, though, about the appellate process, and I just don't understand why, if you have more and new information, is it the county itself not wanting to open this up and investigate further? Where is the breakdown?
It's in several spots. One is in the CCA's refusal to hear it, to order it back for an investigation. It's in the county's refusal to actually look at this and take a hard look at the detective's files and the testimony and the DA's files. You know, it's been very frustrating that no matter what facts you seem to throw at either the CCA or certain district attorney's offices, they're very content to ignore them. And in the CCA's case, they're hiding behind procedural rules that would normally be open to this because it would involve either government misconduct or an actual innocence claim. And that is what we are facing is a person. It's not that one side has proven this one way or the other. It's that they won't hear it. Mm-hmm. And that's the danger in any kind of execution. I grant to those whose family members are deceased that this has been a long time, and it obviously has been brought up in a prior writ, but the problem is that no one has done the kind of actual searching investigation that these accusations should have mandated. When you have a recantation, in fact, one of the cases in the Texas system, Ex Parte Elizondo, is about two young kids who later recanted their accusations against their grandfather of sexual assault. They admitted that they had made it up, and actual innocence relief was granted in the state court for that. In other cases like Ex Parte Chabot, where the state has sponsored false evidence, they have granted stays and gone in and done the work to actually review these cases and see if the state either knowingly or unknowingly sponsored false evidence. Death is different for a reason. You want to be certain. And in this case, I don't think anyone's going to be certain. And I am very sad that the jurors and those who participated in this trial are going to go to sleep or try to sleep tonight on the death of a man who could be innocent. We don't know, and no one's looking.
Let's go now to Clinton Young, a former death row inmate. We will be, as if the execution does proceed, we will be playing a final interview that we recorded in 2023 with Mr. Cantu. But let's talk to Clinton Young at this point. Clinton, did you know Ivan?
Yeah, I knew him. We called him he went by Kangaroo, right? So that's what I always called him, right? Because when he first got there, he had to use the restroom, so they wouldn't. He was stuck out on the outside rec yard, and in prison, you only have a urinal out there, so you can't, you know, use the restroom another way. And so he was kicking on the glass, and somebody said he was kicking like a kangaroo. So, man, it stuck, right? But yeah, I knew Roo, man. He was a cool dude, right? Like, laid back, outgoing, and tell you what, I wasn't there, but he fought his case while he was on death row. It's like an innocent man. You know, there's a saying police have with they look at a suspect when they first take it into custody. You know, they said a guilty man lays down and goes to sleep, and innocent man crawls the wall. Mm. That ain't always true, but he fought his case like he was innocent. That's for sure, right?
Well, he sure has convinced a lot of people that he is innocent. I mean, it's a high profile case when you have celebrities like Martin Sheen and Kim Kardashian and Sister Helen Prejean publicly leading the charge to stop the execution.
Yeah, you know, Pat talked about the deathbed confession. And in American law, the deathbed confession, it has a long history all the way back to when the Boston Massacre happened, when all the Boston Tea Party and all that stuff was going on. There was a, I forget, it's been years, but there was somebody that was on their deathbed. And they made a dying declaration, and that alone was enough. Which, I mean, Pat might know more about it. I can't. It's been so long, but like that was enough to convict him. If I'm not mistaken on that, I have to go back and look. Like I said, it's been about 15 years, but I read this whole interesting piece on deathbed confession. Mm. But under American jurisprudence, I mean, it's like. It carries a tremendous amount of weight because they say when will a person most likely tell the truth rather than when they're at the cusp of meeting their maker.
Right.
You know? And so that's why it holds so much weight. But yet here in this situation here, it's like, whatever, you know. And then I read some article, like they said he had took a Rolex, but they ended up finding the Rolex. And so the DA is like, well, he wanted to rob him for drugs. Okay, I know somebody on death row that has a legitimate self-defense claim. If he'd been like, you know, a regular upstanding person in society running a store and somebody came in and robbed his store and he shot the store owner, or I mean, not the store owner, but shot the robber, then he'd been congratulated on the evening news. Hmm. But he wasn't living that type of lifestyle. And so somebody tried to kill him. He defends himself. And they say, oh, well, you know, you don't have self-defense and if you're involved in selling drugs. Well, now they're saying in Cantu's case, oh, well, you know, he's going to rob him for drugs. So, I mean, either the drugs matter or the drugs don't matter, you know. But to get to Kangaroo on a personal level, right, he was liked by a lot of people, right? I mean, he was a cool guy. Funny, you know, always into sports and NASCAR, et cetera, right? He said that was his third execution date.
This is his third execution date. He had his first one was in 2011, and then of course last year in April 2023.
Yeah, I knew he had at least one other one, right? That within itself should be like. Kind of a fact of torture he'd get on the execution days.
Well, but, exactly. I mean, what does your mind go through when you are told, notified that you have an execution date?
You know, it's interesting. Like, a lot of people, when they first get there, like, they kind of bury their head in the sand and they're distracted by all these other things. And they really don't focus on their case until the Fifth Circuit rules on it. And the Fifth Circuit rules on it, that kind of triggers something to people because they know it's okay, this is serious now, right? Like it's up to the Supreme Court. And so I'm about to get an execution date. And you know, me myself, I stayed on my case so much that like as soon as the Court of Criminal Appeals denied my appeal, to me it was like the Supreme Court denying it, right?
Right.
And so, so it's different for different people, but Cantu, I mean, you know, Kangaroo, he was like me, right? Like he was on his case so much that every denial was kind of like it kind of knocks the wind out of you, right?
Right.
Like, especially if you know, like, dang, I have things. This is what hurts. This is what really gets you the most, right? Like, when you're going through that and you get an execution date, is the fact that when you're looking at everything that you have in front of your case, if you was tried today, would they have achieved the same outcome? Mm-hmm. And the answer many times is no. And so that's the thing, is like you're sitting there and you're like, dang, man, if I could just get on the list, if I could just get one more chance to get back in front of that jury.
Right, right.
And then, unfortunately, like, sadly, too many times it doesn't happen, right? I mean, yeah. A person isn't able to do that.
Well, we are about to actually play one of our interviews that we did at the Polonsky unit with our producer, Elizabeth Stein, in 2023. Has anyone heard from Linda Snyder in Huntsville? Linda, can you hear me? Is anything happening there?
Yeah. Well, the only person that got in the van to go into the execution was the chaplain, because Ivan asked that he wanted no witnesses. He just wanted Helen Prejean to be with him. And so only the chaplain got in the car with a couple of guards. So we're waiting for the car to come back.
Okay.
And then we'll know it's over.
So for our normal way of saying is, this is the signal to our listeners that the execution has begun. When the observers would cross the road, at this point now they get into a van and have to go into the back of the facilities because of the construction that's going on in this old 1848 building. Thank you so much, Linda. Please let us know when they come back. We would greatly appreciate that. And at the moment, let's go ahead and run this particular article. As the state of Texas begins its lethal injection that will end Ivan's life, we bring you this interview recorded in Livingston at the Polonsky unit in 2023 by our own Houston media source partners and our producer here at Execution Watts, Elizabeth Stein. Here in its entirety is our interview with Ivan Cantu.
Ivan, thanks so much for agreeing to talk to us.
You're welcome.
As you know, this is your opportunity to say whatever it is you want to say.
Sure.
About 20 minutes, and we do not edit or cut what you say. So that's why when Mark says it's time, and we have to stop.
Okay.
Because we won't cut it.
Time is key.
Yes, yeah,
sure.
Absolutely. And this has turned out to be, when people do want to be interviewed, it has turned out to be one of the most popular parts of the show. People want to hear more interviews. They want to know who is on death row,
right, and
who's being caught up in the process. And I think that's so important for people to see that the people on death row bear really no resemblance to the image that's being projected.
Right, but until you have a family member here, or you know somebody within the prison system, or you arrive and see it for yourself, you don't really know what it is.
No, you picture something out of Silence of the Lambs.
Sure.
Where there's a hallway.
Yeah, you do. You picture the worst of the worst.
Yeah, there's people yelling at you, and there's Hannibal Lecter at the end of the hallway.
Right. Well, I mean, it's misconstrued. This place isn't like that. It might have been in the past or even before, you know, in general population settings. But even in this setting here, there are good, genuine people here. If you remove the drama, the drugs, or the craziness from their lives or whatever stress they were dealing with in the free world, and you remove and strip it from these people and just let them be people, there's some good, genuine, honest people here. And the world wouldn't believe that. I mean, they would, you know, I'm not just talking about, you know, myself, but I'm talking about people that are deemed worst of the worst here.
Yes, thank you for saying deemed. Yes, it is presented that way.
Right.
But we know differently. And to me, the most important thing is not for me to say or you to say, but for people to judge for themselves.
Absolutely.
See you, listen to you, make up their own minds.
Right.
And this is, as you know, a chance for you to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Right.
And had you thought about what you want to say, or?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I want the world to know that the death penalty is wrong, because, you know, going back to what I just said a minute ago, they, you know, deemed a lot of these people here, including myself, as throwaways, as if, you know, we don't have a right or a chance to exist. And usually, when it gets to this, if it was to get to this point, I mean, there's really not a whole lot of sense of me rehashing my case and constantly reiterating my innocence and all the evidence pertaining to my case. Because if this interview was to air, then, you know, my case has run its course, and apparently the courts didn't agree with me. And I have already done everything that I can do within the media, social media, my legal team, to put it out there to the world to prove my case.
I hope this interview never sees the light of day, because it only will if there's a show covering your execution.
That's right.
So I dearly hope that won't happen.
Right, and we're doing everything that we can so that doesn't occur. But the world needs to know that this is a hypocritical situation. And I say that because when they present to the jury that that the people back here need to be executed, even on regular physical evidence, they have junk science. Well, a lot of it on the psychological side is junk science too, because as many times as they try to predict who's a future danger and who's going to prevent, you know, criminal acts of violence in the free world or even in the prison world back here, they're wrong. It's not true.
Of course, in Texas, future danger is something that the jury is asked to determine and is supposed to be a requirement before you sentence someone to death.
That's right. They pose two questions to the courts that if it's probable or more probable or likely that they're going to commit, you know, criminal acts of violence, not just within the free world, but in a prison society. But it's a misnomer, and it's not correct, because, you know, when you leave the courthouse to come here, you go straight into a segregated cell. So you're not around other people in any time. And the cells are secure, or at least, you know, they should be. That's a requirement of the prison system. But any time you are transported, whether you go to visit or to recreation or to the shower, you're in cuffs. I mean, now, mind you, people are creative over the years, and there have been some incidences. But as a whole and across the board, I mean, that's not the case. Right.
Absolutely. And there seems to be a certain level of energy, too, devoted to, in order to sell the continued use of the death penalty, there's a certain amount of energy seems to be devoted to portraying people on death row as being throwaway, as you say, but also kind of like animals who need to be put down.
Right.
Yeah. I do.
Yeah, well, that's the banner of the bumper sticker that they portray in trial. And it's not, and like I said, unless you, you know, or a volunteer that comes through these doors to visit people, or someone involved in the chaplaincy, or you have, you know, friends from, you know, we're blessed to have friends from overseas, you know, befriend us and support us and come visit us.
Yes, I've met a number of them.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure you have. But, you know, through the course of that, those introductions of those friendships, those or people that are, you know, even employed by the prison system, I mean, they'll tell you, hey, that death row is not the worst of the worst. You know, if when they're short-staffed and they work at the other units, or they even work in the population setting, they're more on guard, or they're more aware of their environment than they are back here. Yeah, so I mean, it's not the case. These people are not the worst of the worst.
What do you think people need to know most about the people on death row? That's not just what they're not, but what would you want people to
the
know?
Positive attributes that apply?
Whatever you think.
There's each and every person that I've come across and met, besides someone that has a serious psychological problem, in those situations, the unit will transport them to Jester 4, which is a psychiatric unit. For instance, one of them is scheduled, I will get back to your question, but since we're on that road, I do want to point this out. One of them is Andre Thompson, and Andre Thomas, I believe his name. Andre Thomas. He's on the schedule for April 5th. The state of Texas deems that he's, not, I guess, crazy or psychological problems. And this is a gentleman that was in the day room who plucked out his eyeball and ate it in front of the officers. He has serious psychological problems.
And then his other eye.
That's right.
The same.
Right. He's legally blind. He's at Jester 4. He's not even in the section with us or even on this unit, but they're going to transport him to Huntsville for execution.
Yeah, when I submitted a request to interview him, I was told he was not available.
He's not here at the unit. Did you submit to the Jester 4 unit? Or Jester 3, wherever they're housing him? Because he's not here.
I was just told he's not eligible.
Okay. Okay.
But that's a good, yeah. If he's eligible to be executed, isn't he eligible to be interviewed?
That's right.
I'll pursue that.
Right. But if you, each and everybody here has a talent, whether it's drawing, writing, being, you know, crafty with their hands. Everybody here, like I said, except for the exception of the few that have psychological problems, I mean, each and everybody. And what's beautiful about this place, even though we live in solitary confinement, people, they learn to think outside the box, or they figure out and they hone what gifts that they have or what they can or can't do when they didn't know that in the past. So, I mean, that's this place is a blessing and a curse. Because, I mean, it's horrible living in a box for as long as we have. I've lived in solitary confinement for 22 years.
Well, how have you maintained your sanity?
I do everything I can to keep my mind busy, whether it's reading, working on my case, reading case law, reading books. But eventually, you know, it gets to the point to where you've read so many books, and a lot of times you have to dictate your day as to what's going on with your schedule, whether it be recreation, whether they're short-staffed, if they're, you know, running showers. And then you can, because, I mean, there's times where if you have to tackle a task, you want to be able to clear your mind and take care of that, whether, you know, it be reading or, you know, writing a letter or working on your case. But it's different for each person, and each person deals and adapts with this place differently.
What are some of the biggest adaptations you've had to make?
Repeat that one more time.
What are some of the biggest adaptations you've had to make?
As far as, you know, adapting to this place, being away from your friends and family. Right, and communicate, you know, communication's key. And it wasn't until COVID till they really started helping us with the phone calls.
How have you, what are some of the things you've had to do to adapt to being physically separated from your family?
Write letters, right? I mean, it's gotten better because in 2010 or 2011, that's when we were able to get communication faster from the outside world through the JPay system, which was a blessing, and so they could get with us within 24 to 48 hours.
And but the JPay system is?
It's an electronic system to where it's basically a printed email. Right. And of course, we were blessed with the tablets, which actually rolled out. We knew that we were going to get them in November 2021, but they didn't actually roll out till December.
Does everyone have a tablet?
Everyone has a tablet. Unless there's a special circumstance to where they're in a situation where it's kept from them for disciplinary actions or security purposes, but yeah, everybody has a tablet. But now not everybody has the same features. Death Row and SEG, their features are limited compared to the general population. So, I mean, we still have access to e-books. We don't have access to, I'm sorry, let me run through what we do have. Basically, we have access to the e-books, a Panda, which is a Christian application, the e-messenger,
a radio. How we've communicated.
Right. The basic functions. But at this time, we're currently waiting for the phone app to be installed and for the media center and for the podcast. But the general population has that. We don't. That's right.
You do your own podcast, or how would the podcast feature work?
Well, no. It's an application that they assigned to the tablet, just like they do the e-messenger or for the electronic books.
Right.
But you would just tap on the icon and it would present you with a menu that you can actually go through to listen to.
Okay.
Through that app on the tablet, it's not anything that we can speak into through the world. We don't have access to the internet, but it's for audio, unless that one was actually produced and created and designed to have video attached to it, then I think it would apply then.
Have the tablets helped you keep in touch with your family?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a game changer. It really is. And it should be, because now, even, you know, through this snail mail system, you know, when you're trying to, you know, work on your case or just communicate with your family or deal with, you know, family situations or problems, this NAMA system's a wreck. I mean, you're looking at, you know, minimum 2 to 3 weeks turnaround time on your letters. And I mean, even, you know, the tablet's not perfect. It does have some problems. It has some quirks. But even if it's at a 1 or 2 day turnaround, I mean, it's still a lot better than what it was. But it's not perfect, but it's better.
Yeah, letters were just unworkable.
Right.
It would take so long for them to get back and forth.
Right.
Well, I'm glad that the tablets were introduced. Are they like iPads?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They are.
Or they
but,
are
I mean, keep
iPads.
In mind, I've never actually seen an iPad. I mean, okay. I've seen them in the magazines. But but it's something similar.
Yeah, they're about. Well, I have an iPad Mini, and they're like.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with you. They're about the size of a 6x9 envelope,
okay.
And the screen's decent. Everything's touchscreen.
Yeah.
But I mean, without us having technology for over 20 years, it was a culture shock.
Yeah.
But within a day or two, I mean, you've got it figured out. Or if there was something you didn't know, there was people around you that you could. Talk to her, ask questions.
Well, how did your family react to your having that access?
They were pleased. Yeah, especially my mom. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because, well, I mean, we're able to communicate within a one or two day turnaround, you know, even with my, you know, my cousins or my family or my friends and the people that support and love me. Sure.
How did that change your communication? The content of it.
The content, I would say, remained the same
with your family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I would say everything that I'm discussing or putting within, you know, a typed letter or through penmanship or the typewriter, it has remained the same. That hasn't changed.
Yeah.
What has changed is the time turnaround. I mean, which is huge for someone that has an execution date.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, every second, every day counts.
In particular, yeah. What. As your date gets closer, I hate to bring this up, but what?
Oh no, you're. I mean, I'm an open book. Asking.
Okay.
How does that
affect you to have your date getting close? I think it
doesn't.
It's really.
It doesn't. It doesn't affect me either way. And I say that just because I'm at peace. This isn't the first time I've had an execution date. I've gone through this before.
How many times?
As you know, this is my second time. But the first time was in. As a matter of fact. You didn't actually reach out to me, but you had reached out to members of my legal team at the time in 2011. In the event we got close to that situation, but we didn't. But the first time was harder than it is this time, because at that time, as I was nearing execution, you know, I was preparing my letters and saying goodbye to people, and. Something else that made it worse was I got a disciplinary case while I was on death watch for passing a magazine, and so they stripped me of my visits and all of my electronics and my food.
Right, with your date, with
that's
your...
right. I've got an execution date. I'm so many days out.
And you
at
passed
the time.
A magazine to another prisoner.
I did. Yeah.
And your death date stare you in the face.
Right.
They cut you
off. They cut my visits in half. They took all of my electronics, and I was limited on commissary. And then and doing everything I could to stay, you know, to fight with, or to keep in contact with my family, and then coordinate with my attorney to get everything done. It was tough, but I got it done. I mean, I can't say just me. I mean, this is a team effort.
What would you tell people about? This is a question I like to ask, and that is, what would you tell people about? The difference between you when you came in, when you entered death row, and the person you are now?
Well, the time factor has been 22 years, pushing 23 years.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 28 when I got here. Okay. I was 28 when I got here. I'll be 50 in June. The difference is I think you learn patience. I'd have to say one of the strongest elements or attributes would be patience. You have to learn. I mean, you're not happy about it, but you learn it. It's timing's everything. It's a patience process. Yeah, and let me see how I can say this. Say this the right way.
Take your time.
Sometimes you have to worry about the things you control. Every day is not going to be perfect. The operations are going to be different. The inmates are going to, I mean, you're dealing with several different mechanics that make this place operate. And if you can just learn how to, you know, not let it steal your joy and the drama or craziness or the stress roll off of you, you'll be okay. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm a lot more calm and relaxed than I am today than I was, you know, even in my, you know, early 30s to early 40s.
Mm-hmm. So you've undergone a gradual change.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what do you think has been the most important thing that helped you to grow?
Friendships here. You do. You build. You meet people, and you. I mean, not everybody's going to get along, but through the course of being here, you're gonna find who you relate to, who's within your same, you know, mindset, and you. That doesn't necessarily mean that you subscribe to everything that's the same. I mean, some of my best friends here, I mean, we're literally, you know, sometimes I say opposites attract. And I agree to that. I mean, sometimes you can have completely different mindsets or completely different views on things, but yet you're able to align and realize that, you know, who's important to you and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
But friendships help you get through this place, absolutely.
And I would guess contact with your family because you've had their support.
Right.
How unusual is that to have active support from your family among people on death row?
I don't understand.
Oh, do most people have family support?
Most people do, but there are some that don't. There are people there that have been abandoned by their families or their friends or their situations, but they're... And as a whole or as a group, we recognize that, and you know, we do what we can to help somebody get on their feet and get going. But death row is also special because we get support from people to help us and befriend us and actually help us get through this. Because when you arrive here, I mean, they barely give you little bitty bars of soap. They don't give you shampoo. The toothpaste, the toothbrush that they provide is basic. It's men's trash. But I mean, they don't. This place does not even provide deodorant. So I mean, within a day or two, I mean, you can shower each day if they're running showers. But they don't even give you deodorant here. Your first day here, you've got to get deodorant from somebody else. So somebody has to have a caring heart, and you know, the willingness to help you. I mean, it happens. We do it. It's the right thing to do.
Okay, so you. So, say a new person comes in, what happens? Are you able to get supplies to them?
Like creatively, we can't. We do or we will, because they don't have anything. They don't. Yeah. You know, they don't even have a cup. So, when somebody arrives here, that next chow, if and they don't always keep styrofoam cups in the picket, which is the command center for the officers that work the pod. They don't even have a cup. And so, I mean, it depends on who's here, you know, that day. But for the most part, you can talk to an officer and explain the situation. They'll pass it to them. But then sometimes they're calloused to not wanting to do it because of the administration telling them not to pass for us. But for the most part, they will. But it's to their discretion.
Okay, so there are COs who are compassionate and will help you.
Yeah,
help
normally in a situation like that, what we'll do is we'll put together a care package. I mean, because we know for one thing, you're not gonna make commissary or purchase store for anywhere between 10 to 14 days. They're gonna give you an ID.
Okay, so you can't buy your own supplies and hygiene products until
that's right. You're not operational. There's nothing you can do till you have your ID card. Sometimes that can take, you know, 2 weeks. So we already know that they're 2 weeks out. So as together as a group, we're going to round up some soups. We're going to get you a starter kit to get going. So you're not starving, and you can have a pen, a paper, and start communicating with your family and get the word out and get going. Sure.
That comes from the fellow prisoners.
That's right.
What sort of reactions do the new people have when that happens?
It varies. Some people are open-minded to it, and they realize that, hey, this is a compassion move, and they're open-minded to it and they accept it. But it's a rarity. But there have been situations where right out of the gate, somebody would say, oh no, I don't want anything from nobody, because either they've been in a prison setting before or in population, or they'll see that something from a TV show to where they believe that, hey, there's a give and take, or there's something that's owed for it, and that's not the case. And we reiterate and explain that to them. But no, this is a gift of love from everybody, and this is basically your starter kit to get going.
So they come to Death Row.
You're not starting, you get on your feet,
and they can learn more about love.
Sure. Yeah.
Very good. Very good.
Well, but speaking of that situation, I mean, how are we doing on time?
Oh, I'm told we've hit time.
Okay.
Yeah, I apologize. It always feels like it's been 2 minutes, but it's been 20.
Okay.
So I thank you so much for talking to us, for talking to the people who are going to be watching and listening.
Excellent.
Yeah, and again, I hope this never sees the light of day. But all the shows since we started this in 2008 are on executionwatch.org.
Right.
And also on HMS TV. That's another, since the past year or so, we've also been televising.
Right.
Locally and on the internet.
Absolutely.
So it's all archived.
In closing, I do want to send a message to a couple guys. I want to let Jedediah Murphy, Brian Davis, Randy Halpern, Anthony Medina, Andy Canales, Rodney Reed, Tony Ford, who's a Buno, Garcia White. Love those guys. They've been tremendous friends over the years, and they've definitely helped me get through this place.
Very good. Thank you so much, Ivan.
Blessing. Stay in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Excellent. All right. I was going to say, yeah. Let's pray to God this doesn't air, right?
What's up?
I said, let's pray to God this doesn't air.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
We've been listening to an interview recorded in April of 2023 with Ivan Cantu. We have not received the signal that the chaplains have returned from the execution, but we have to assume that the life of Ivan Cantu has come to an end. Rest in peace, Ivan. May your passing help the healing of those who demanded it and the state who endorsed it. Larry, what did you take away from this interview?
Well, Marlo, just watching him reminds me of having seen that much of the celebrity interest in this case was caused as a result of Cantu sending a letter to Sister Prejean.
Right.
Saying, if I should go, I want you to be holding my hand. He is so consistent in his position, and he's at a disadvantage in the trial, mm-hmm. but his position is, this is a drug bust sting, a drug hit. The witnesses who support the introduction of all the evidence against me, mm-hmm. are just not credible. And so now in the end, we find the witnesses now recanted virtually everything they said. And if it were not for that, if the witnesses were not sponsoring all of the evidence that was introducing it, the physical evidence that was introduced against him, there would have been no conviction.
Right.
And that troubles me.
Pat, what did you take away from this? From Ivan Cantu saying, not let this place steal your joy. What did you take away from this particular interview? Pat.
He's muted.
Pat's muted. Pat McCann, now you're not muted.
Yeah, sorry. Finding that kind of resilience in such a dark place is... I think inspirational a little bit, but I also feel sadly that this was not going to be the first questionable execution we have this year. If they're willing to start with this fellow and with this many questions, I'm afraid I'm losing optimism for good sense to prevail for the rest of the year.
Right. Clinton, let me let you have the last word, please.
Yeah, I wanted to say so. Could I? One thing, like you see, Cantu is well spoken, right? And I really appreciate it. I highlighted a lot of things about the conditions of death row and how people are when they first arrive. That is something that's unique to death row. Because you always hear when you go to prison, don't accept nothing from nobody, right?
Right.
And when I first got there, I was like, hell no. I don't want nothing, right? Like, but I've been locked up before. I was like, I don't know you. But something else, you said that his lawyer, and I looked it up, didn't file nothing in the Supreme Court. I don't care if there's nothing to file. I don't care if the issue's been denied. You file something. You always file something.
Right.
Because you never know what's going to catch traction. Look at the guy who first filed the lawsuit about not allowing the chaplain into
the death chamber.
Execution. Yeah, and right. Look what that did to executions, especially right. In Texas. So you never know what's going to catch traction, right?
No, you never
especially
know.
Especially if you have legitimate. Wow. Look, people know I used to get into my attorneys all the time. Ooh-wee, man.
Well, Clinton, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. And thanks to everybody, because we are going to bring this show to a close. So we welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. Go to executionwatch.org to learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas. And subscribe to our mailing list if you don't mind. You can also find us on Facebook. Just search Execution Watch and past shows on YouTube. We can now be found on Twitter as well, and we'd appreciate a follow. Our thanks again to the entire Execution Watch crew, legal analyst Larry Douglas, Pat McCann, reporters Linda Snyder and Clinton Young, video director Mark Pertle, technical director Otis McClay, engineer Howard Reynolds, and of course our executive producer Elizabeth Stein. Just a reminder that your support is critical to keeping this broadcast commercial-free and on the air. Please pledge your support for Execution Watch now at kpft.org. And if you're listening live right now on 90.1 FM, stay tuned for Living Art with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson. This has been Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.
Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?